are at the root of this crisis.
Well, in one of my documentaries, I actually interviewed Fred Hampton's wife, Okuya Najiri, who was lying in bed beside him when the FBI and Chicago police opened fire with about 100 rounds. Imagine this. Well, let's listen to her firsthand account of what took place and also from their son, Fred Hampton Jr.
Yeah, I might be anywhere, but when I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips, that I am a revolutionary, and you're going to have to keep on saying that.
Fred Hampton was a 21-year-old chairman of the Illinois Black Panthers. The Black Panther Party was striving for the independence of blacks and implemented many social programs.
Can you run me through that, exactly what happened?
Well, on the night of December 3rd,
someone came into the room, started shaking the chairman. They said, chairman, wake up, the pigs are laughing.
The pigs had knocked on the front door, and Mark Clark said, who's there? And the response came back, Tommy. Mark Clark said, Tommy who? Tommy Gunn. They kicked the door in and just started shooting.
And I saw bullets coming from, it looked like, the front of the apartment, from the kitchen area.
I could see, like, sparks going in front of the doorway, like shots. I could smell cordite from all the gunshots. And our bed was vibrating like this.
They kept calling out, stop shooting, stop shooting. We have a pregnant woman, a pregnant sister in here. At the time, I was 8.5 to 9 months pregnant. My baby was to be delivered in 2 weeks.
The pregnant sister was my mother-to-be, then Deborah Johnson, now Okuya and Jerry. She's 8.5 months pregnant with me at the time.
Anybody that's been under gunshot know that 5 minutes is 5 hours. You think it's forever. Mm-hmm. And I found out later that this whole assassination took a total of maybe 15 minutes.
Heard a pig say, he's barely alive, he'll barely make it. They started shooting again. I heard the sister scream. They stopped shooting. Pig said, he's good and dead now. Pigs running around laughing, they were really happy, you know, talking about Chairman Fred is dead. I never saw Chairman Fred again.
And I remember saying to myself in my head, you better not stumble, you better not fall, because they will shoot you and say that you're trying to get a gun. So I'm trying to walk, I'm very pregnant, and we're coming out, and there were two lines of pigs I had to walk through. One of them grabbed my robe open, and they started laughing, and they said, what you know, we got a broad here. They grabbed me by the hair and slung me into the kitchen area.
As soon as Sergeant Daniel Groth and officers James Davis, who were leading our men, announced their office, occupants of the apartment attacked them with shotgun fire. The officers immediately took cover. The occupants continued firing at our policemen from several rooms within the apartment. Thereafter, three times, Sergeant Groth ordered all his men to cease firing and told the occupants to come out with their hands up. Each time, one of the occupants replied, shoot it out, and continued firing at the police officers.
People came through the apartment because they didn't believe the reenactment that then state's attorney Edward Hanrahan was doing, where he talked about how the police were met, his brave police officers were met with a barrage of gunfire from the vicious Black Panthers. And people lined up all around the block to come through and see. And through the state's own sticks, they put these sticks in the holes, through the trajectories of the bullets, they could see 90% of the shots were aimed at the head where Chairman Fred.
Well, let's cross back over to Johanna and listen to more of her comments on all of this. Well, Johanna, what happened actually to social activism for change in the U.S.?
Well, movements are not forever, and there's always an ebb and flow. And part of what we've seen is a tremendous uprising, among the largest uprisings in American history, following the George Floyd murder,
right,
by. And, of course, this happened at a very specific moment when there was a lockdown in this country because of the pandemic, and when many people witnessed the inability of the American government to respond to something like a pandemic. So there was a sense of powerlessness. And then we have this horrific atrocity. And there was an uprising of epic proportion. However, movements are different than uprisings and mass demonstrations. Movements are accompanied by the emergence of organizations and sustained organizing and struggle in the streets that essentially create a strategy that have some kind of theory of how change can happen that is then deployed. And that we haven't seen in part because part of what COINTELPRO did was to eviscerate organizations and their leaders and disconnected an older generation of activists and organizers with future generations. So COINTELPRO eroded the tradition of organizing and protest in this country. And so what we've seen in the last 40, 50 years in the main has been mass angry protests that have come and gone.
Well, thanks so much for being with us, Johanna Fernandez. Well, being a tip of the iceberg while looking at the effects of COINTELPRO, some of the best potential leaders were assassinated. Some had to flee in exile, and others are still incarcerated today after spending decades in prison. Well, this is the best way to destroy any movement. You remove the head, and then basically you have a headless body. Correct information and education are key. That is the reason that education was always one of the main goals of the Black Panthers. They wanted to teach the kids their history. Well, unfortunately, as a 12-year-old, I didn't have the opportunity to be taught my own history. I didn't know the man, J. Edgar Hoover, whose obituary I was reading had been one of the most ruthless enemies of civil rights and other minority movements in the United States. Well, the effects of COINTELPRO is still very much alive. And next week, we will look at political prisoners in the United States and how COINTELPRO was fundamental in having prisoners incarcerated for 4 and 5 decades. Thank you so much for being with us right here at Hidden Files. And make sure we hear from you on our various social media platforms. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the Limelight.
Small teams of U.S. Special Operations Forces are involved in a low-profile proxy war program on a far greater scale than previously known, according to exclusive documents and interviews with more than a dozen current and former government officials. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Nick Terse and Alice Sperry, authors. This article is published under the heading, How the Pentagon Uses a Secretive Program to Wage Proxy Wars. Stay tuned for the second part of this article, please. While the documents obtained by The Intercept offer clues about the scope and contours of the 127E program, much remains unknown to both the public and members of Congress. Relevant reports required by law are classified at a level that prevents most congressional staffers from accessing them. A government official familiar with the program who requested anonymity to discuss it estimated that only a handful of people in Congress, Armed Services, and Intelligence Committees read such reports. Congressional Foreign Affairs and Relations Committees, even though they have primary responsibility for deciding where the U.S. is at war and can use force, do not receive them. And most congressional representatives and staff with clearance to access their reports do not know to ask for them. It's true that any member of Congress could read any of these reports, but I mean, they don't even know they exist, the government official added. It was designed to prevent oversight. But it is not just Congress that's largely kept in the dark about the program. Officials at the State Department with the relevant expertise are also often unaware. While 127E requires sign-off by the chief of mission in the country where the program is carried out, detailed information is rarely shared by those diplomats with officials in Washington. The lack of oversight across levels of the U.S. government is in part the result of the extreme secrecy with which defense officials have shielded their authority over the program, and of the scant pushback they have faced. It's a state not knowing what they do not know, so they don't even know to ask. It's the ambassadors being sort of vowed by these four-star generals who come in and say, if you don't let us do this, everyone's going to die, the government official said, adding, the Department of Defense views this as a small, tiny program that doesn't have foreign policy implications, so let's just do it. The less people get in our way, the easier. Sarah Harrison, a senior analyst at the International Crisis Group and formerly associate general counsel at the Defense Department's Office of General Counsel International Affairs, echoed that assessment. HASC and SASC appear opposed to increasing oversight of 127 ECHO. They're not inclined to change the statute to strengthen a state's oversight, nor are they adequately sharing documents related to the program with personal congressional staff, she said, using the acronyms of the House Armed Services Committee and the State Armed Services Committee. This may seem like an arcane bureaucratic issue, but it really matters for oversight of the 127 ECHO program and all other programs that are run in secret. Those programs include an authority known as Section 1202 that first appeared in the 2018 National Defense Authorization Act and provides support to foreign forces, irregular forces, groups, or individuals that are taking part in irregular warfare and are explicitly focused on so-called near-peer competitors. Congress has also authorized the Secretary of Defense to expand up to $15 million in any fiscal year for clandestine activities for any purpose the Secretary determines to be proper or for preparation of the environment for operations of a confidential nature. Under 10 U.S.C. 127F or 127 Foxtrot. Section 1057 authority similarly allows for intelligence and counterintelligence activities in response to threats of a confidential, extraordinary, or emergency nature. Stephen Semler, co-founder of the Security Policy Reform Institute, a grassroots-funded U.S. foreign policy think tank, said, "This has been sort of the story for a lot of these Department of Defense-run programs. The special operations community likes autonomy a lot. They don't like going through bureaucracy, so they always invent authorities, trying to find ways around having their operations delayed for any reason." He added, "The problem is this stuff is so normalized. There should be more attention paid to these train and equip authorities, whether it's special forces or DOD regular, because it's really kind of a PR-friendly way to sell endless war."
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The devastating impact of the coronavirus pandemic and its economic fallout continue to take a toll on the world and provide ample reason to reconsider where taxpayers' money is being spent. Several countries have even come to the conclusion that their budget is better off being spent where it can potentially ameliorate the economic pressure on their citizens. In the U.S., however, while such reassessments are long overdue along with the trillions of dollars Congress and successive administrations have lavished on the Pentagon, lawmakers have decided to once again shower the Pentagon with cash, even more than what it asked for. Interestingly enough, this comes while the massive U.S. arsenal and fighting force deployed worldwide have proven to be powerless against grave, non-military threats to national security. Gas prices in the U.S. are at an all-time high. Rent prices have set records for the last 13 months straight. Inflation is increasing so sharply that even the cost of basic utilities has risen by nearly 30% in the last 12 months. There are growing fears that the economy is poised to fall into recession. And now, at a time when Americans are fighting to keep roofs over their heads and feed their families, Congress's plan is to authorize a record-setting $838.8 billion in spending to the Pentagon, nearly $40 billion more than what the military asked for.
American taxpayers should be angry. They are angry. Many are not only angry, they are incensed, and they are protesting. But unfortunately, too many elected representatives in this country aren't listening to their constituents. They're listening to the representatives and the lobbyists of the military-industrial complex, such as Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Boeing, and General Electric. So when you have those companies and so many others, that are pouring millions and millions and millions of dollars into the political campaigns of members of Congress and members of the Senate and the president, when they are pouring millions of dollars into their political campaigns, when they spend just an inordinate amount of time on Capitol Hill lobbying for their interests, then you're going to wind up with policies and programs that are sending money to the Pentagon instead of sending money into states for schools and retirement programs and the other types of social welfare programs and that are needed in this country.
The U.S. Congress is on track to give the Pentagon $37 billion more than what the military asked for. And this comes while Congress could use this money to pay for a variety of things Americans desperately need right now, like school lunches, affordable housing, and utility assistance programs. Even just lowering taxes by that amount or giving this money directly to the American people could put more than $100 in the pocket of every single American at a time when they desperately need it. Not only would spending in such ways benefit the individuals and communities that receive them, it would also help revitalize the U.S. economy and make it more equitable to boot. As has been well documented, defense spending is one of the least economically productive ways the government can spend its money. Spending on education, healthcare, and lowering taxes, for example, have all been shown to create more and higher-paying jobs. So why is Congress poised to give government contractors the biggest taxpayer-funded payday they've ever received, despite the heavy economic implications that the move has on the country?
Well, the reason that the United States government is pursuing war strategies is because America is still an imperial hegemon. And so you have people like Tony Blinken and Avril Haines, Samantha Power, Jake Sullivan, Victoria Nuland, that are influencing decision makers in policy to try to start fights with Russia, try to start conflicts with China, start to continue to start conflicts with Iran to justify this immense military spending.
Pentagon contractors invest heavily in efforts to get more taxpayer money. They've spread their influence and money around the lobbyists, PR firms, and think tanks to ensure that the money is funneled in their way. In short, this is the military-industrial complex, and it is working overtime to raise the Pentagon budget at taxpayers' expense. And while much of Washington is on the racket and will also profit from this wasteful government spending, it's Americans struggling to keep the lights on who will pay the price. President Biden has almost unlimited ways of communicating with the world, but he opted to pen an article posted online Saturday night by the Washington Post to defend his pending West Asia trip in light of the controversies around it. In the piece, he speaks about many issues, including further integrating Israel into the region, Washington's ties with Riyadh, the Saudi-led war in Yemen, the Iran nuclear deal, and more. While most of the matters mentioned in the article are centered around West Asia, they also seem to share another point. The U.S. itself is either complicit in or directly responsible for the very issues it claims that it is trying to solve.
The U.S. Lies through its teeth without stopping a minute. We've seen the debates and discussions about the comprehensive agreement with Iran, which they had promised to renegotiate, and they seem not to be negotiating in good faith. They're trying to paint themselves as innocent, which of course they are not, and they just had a recent rebuff at the G20 meeting in Indonesia, where Mr. Blinken refused to sit down with the leaders of all these states.
Saudi Arabia, infamous for its violations of human rights and under widespread criticism for its bloody war on Yemen as well as the killing of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi, is a focal point of Biden's West Asia tour. But despite this, the US president's framing of the Saudi relationship appeared particularly defensive. During his election campaign, Biden had pledged of making Saudi Arabia a pariah for its crime. But now he has ironically claimed that ties with Riyadh help promote the US's foreign policy ambitions. Similar to the other issues, the US president also tried to take fault away from his administration in regard to the Iran nuclear program file by putting the blame on Iran. Biden also stated his readiness to further pressure Tehran despite Tehran's readiness to return to the deal, and this too sheds light on the US's ironical foreign policy. One of the main purposes of Joe Biden's visit is the sought deepening of Israel's integration in the region and moving forwards with the Abraham Accords, which is the pillar of normalization deals with Israel. But the latter has raised questions regarding Biden's foreign policies as Israel itself seems to be the source of the problem in the region, from its atrocities against Palestinians to its continuous attacks on Syria and its repeated threats against Iran. In the op-ed piece, President Biden says the US helped end the 2021 war on Gaza but fails to condemn Israel for its atrocities and violation of Palestinian rights. Biden also proudly mentions the US's $4 billion support of Israel. But what does all this demonstrate about the US's stance on Palestinians who have been subject to Israeli brutality for years now?
Well, the issue of the United States and Israel is a burning issue right now, and the U.S. has acted in a hypocritical way where Russia has attacked special military operation in Ukraine to denazify it, and we know what Nazis are. So, and yet, so the U.S. has spent $40 or $60 billion arming these countries, letting all those Ukrainian youth be killed who were forced into fighting Russia. And yet, with respect to Gaza, 8 months earlier, Israel unleashed a horrible attack on Gaza, and the U.S. hummed and hawed, tried to sort of say, maybe we'll calm things down. They didn't spend $40 billion to arm the resistance against Israel. And that is a term which I call tongue-in-cheek. I don't know whether you know the term. It's sort of a sarcastic term because obviously the U.S. is not going to do that, but it's related to empire.
The U.S.'s one-sided stance on Israel is also clearly demonstrated in the Shirin Abu Akleh case, where it stopped short of reaching a definitive conclusion in her killing by Israeli troops, while all other investigations reached the conclusion that the regime troops did in fact murder her. Now, despite Israeli crimes, Washington seeks not only to integrate the regime further into the region, but also aims to advance its plans to upgrade defense cooperation between Israel and Arabs in the light of the Abraham Accords. And all this raises the question of whether the US truly seeks justice and advocates for human rights, or it only claims to do so in order to move forward with its agenda. After spending his first year and a half in office mostly trying to avoid deeper engagement in West Asia while prioritizing challenges at home and in other parts of the world such as China and Russia, President Biden seems to be making a slight shift towards dedicating more time and attention to West Asia. One of the main purposes of Joe Biden's visit is the so-called deepening of Israel's integration in the region and moving forward with the Abraham Accords, which is the main pillar of normalization deals with Israel. But the latter has raised questions regarding Biden's foreign policies, as Israel itself seems to be the source of the problem in the region, from its atrocities against Palestinians to its continuous attacks on Syria and its repeated threats against Iran.
Well, Israel has been the problem in the Middle East since their inception. And even before that, when they were under British occupation, Palestine was under British occupation, the Zionists were the cause of the problems in the Middle East, going back to the bombing of the King David Hotel. So Israel has been a really terrible neighbor for all of the surrounding countries to them. You mentioned Syria. Yes, I was in Syria several times when Israel was being the aggressor and actively bombing the Syrian people who've done nothing to them. They occupy Syrian territory in the Golan Heights. Israel has been just a terrible neighbor to everyone. They've been abusive of the Palestinian people. I've been to the Palestinian, what they call camps, refugee camps, and these are 70 years old now. These are not new. These are established communities that they refer to as camps. They drove the people off their land. They stole their land that they have no right and no claim to. So yes, Israel is the nexus of the problem in the Middle East.
Now, despite Israeli crimes, Washington seems to not only integrate the regime further into the region, it also aims to advance its plan to upgrade defense cooperation between Israel and the Arabs in the light of the Abraham Accords. Meanwhile, Iran has reiterated that normalization of relations between some Arab countries and Israel encourages and strengthens the regime to continue its crimes. President Ebrahim Raisi in April even compared friendship with Israel to keeping a snake in proximity. Americans have been feeling the economic pressure of inflation in recent months, with surging domestic gasoline prices adding to that burden. There are expectations that President Biden's trip to Saudi Arabia will include a direct request from the kingdom to increase its oil production in the hopes of offsetting the rising costs for American consumers at the pump. During his campaign, Biden had pledged of making Saudi Arabia a pariah. But now, in a move seen by rights advocates as at odds with his promise to put human rights at the heart of U.S. foreign policy, Biden is set to meet with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman as he struggles to combat record-high U.S. gasoline prices.
Biden has done some very foolish economic policies in the U.S. Initially, like day one after his inauguration, he cut off the Keystone Pipeline. And he turned the United States from an oil exporting country into an oil importing country. What Biden was not counting on was the rest of the world is sanctioning the U.S. and not wanting to deal in dollars, and they're not wanting to supply the U.S. with commodities and or finished goods. So Biden's economic policies have been an unmitigated failure. And so, yes, Biden is going to Saudi Arabia to beg the Saudis to increase oil production.
Meanwhile, the United States is facing accusations of whitewashing the Israeli killing of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh after concluding the bullet that killed her likely came from Israeli military gunfire, but stopping short of reaching a definitive conclusion in her killing. Abu Akleh was wearing a press uniform while reporting on an Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank when she was fatally shot in the head on May 11th. Since the killing, several media and human rights organizations have all determined that the Israeli military killed Abu Akleh. All this raises the question of whether the U.S. truly seeks justice and advocates for human rights, or it only claims to do so in order to move forward with its agenda.
The United Nations has warned the Israeli regime against forcible mass eviction of over 1,000 Palestinians from their homes in the Masafer Yatta area of the occupied West Bank.
Evictions that lead to displacement, if enforced, amount to forced deportation and a grave breach of the Fourth Geneva Convention, and therefore constitute a war crime.
The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs added that the international humanitarian law imposes an absolute prohibition on the forcible transfer of civilians from or within the occupied Palestinian territories, and that Israeli authorities must put an end to all coercive measures, including planned evictions, demolitions, and military training in it.
Well, the Palestinians have been periodically rising up against this ongoing slow-motion Zionist genocide. It's been going on now. The Palestinians have been resisting this genocide for more than a century since it began, when these settlers started swarming into Palestine against the wishes of the Palestinian people. And so that struggle will, of course, continue. And there will be continuing protests. There are basically ongoing peaceful protests in Palestine. And every now and then, the uprising becomes more of a military nature. And then, of course, the Zionists respond in kind, and all kinds of blood is shed. At the end of the day, the Zionists are continuing their slow-motion genocide, but it isn't happening fast enough to save them. In the long run, the Zionist entity is doomed because it hasn't been able to get the actual acquiescence of the Palestinians, first and foremost, and then secondarily, the people of the region.
A ruling by the Israeli Supreme Court on May 4th allowed for the mass eviction of Palestinians in the area. The Israeli military has designated part of the area as a closed military zone for training, and the regime has sought to remove the communities on this basis. The European ambassador to the occupied Palestinian territories has warned against Israel's planned evictions.
If mass evictions and forcible transfer were to be the case, that would be the biggest forcible transfer for decades.
The official added that the EU hopes that upcoming visits of US President Joe Biden to Israel would put pressure on Israel to fulfill its obligations to protect civilians.
The U.S. could stop Israel from all of its crimes if it absolutely turned and chose that path, but it won't. And the reason, of course, is that there's a lot of Zionist power here in the United States, including in the Biden administration, and they're sending a message by saying even when Biden goes to the Middle East, and it would be in his interest and the American interest to have the Israelis modify their behavior, they won't do it. They don't need to do it. They're thumbing their nose at the world. And the Zionists have a long track record of things like this. They never compromise. They never try to go the extra mile to be reasonable.
Although the United States has called on the Israeli regime to stop its settlement drive, but in effect, it has supported the regime in its crimes against Palestinians. U.S. officials have repeatedly hailed Washington's unwavering support for the regime. They have also turned a deaf ear to growing cries from various international organizations regarding the regime's atrocities. The United States has also vetoed numerous resolutions in the U.N. Security Council that criticize the regime.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Virologists have voiced concerns about the emergence of yet another fast-spreading Omicron variant, which is rapidly gaining ground in India and has already arrived in the United Kingdom. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Linda Geddes. The piece is titled Centaurus: Virologists Express Concern at New COVID Subvariant. Virologists have voiced concerns about the emergence of yet another fast-spreading Omicron variant, which is rapidly gaining ground in India and has already arrived in the United Kingdom. The BA.2.75 variant, nicknamed Centaurus, was first detected in India in early May. Here, cases have since risen steeply and apparently faster than those of the extremely transmissible BA.5 variant, which is also present in India and is rapidly displacing the previously dominant BA.2 variant in many countries. BA.2.75 has also since been detected in about 10 other countries, including the United Kingdom, United States, Australia, Germany, and Canada. The European Centre for Disease Prevention and Control, the ECDC, designated it a variant under monitoring on 7th of July, meaning there's some indication that it could be more transmissible or associated with more severe disease, but the evidence is weak or has not yet been assessed. The World Health Organization, WHO, is also closely monitoring the new variant, although its chief scientist, Dr. Soumya Swaminathan, said there weren't yet enough samples to assess its severity. In addition to its apparent rapid growth and wide geographical spread, virologists have been alerted by the sheer number of extra mutations BA.2.75 contains relative to BA.2, from which it is likely to have evolved. This could mean that it has had the chance to evolve an advantage over an already successful virus lineage, said Dr. Stephen Griffin, a virologist at the University of Leeds in England. It's not so much the exact mutations, more the number and combination, said Dr. Tom Peacock, a virologist at Imperial College London, who was the first to identify Omicron as a potential concern back in November of 2021. It's hard to predict the effect of that many mutations appearing together. It gives the virus a bit of a wild card property where the sum of the parts could be worse than the parts individually. It is definitely a potential candidate for what comes after BA.5. Failing that, it's probably the sort of thing will have come along next. That is, a variant of a variant. Even if it doesn't take off in other countries, its growth in India suggests it is likely to be an issue there at the very least. Dr. Peacock added, it's clearly growing pretty well in India, but India hasn't got much BA.5, and it is still very unclear how well it fares against that. Dr. Stephen Griffin cited it as yet another example of the virus's impressive capacity to tolerate changes in its spike protein, the part it uses to infect cells, and which most COVID vaccines are based on. This time last year, many were convinced that Delta variant represented an evolutionary pinnacle for the virus, but the emergence of the Omicron variant and the vast increases in variability and antibody evasiveness is a sign that we cannot, as a population, follow an influenza-like plan to keep pace with the viral evolution, said Dr. Griffin. In addition to vaccines, longer-term plans should include variant-agnostic measures to prevent infections and reinfections. This includes creating infection-resilient environments through improved ventilation, improved filtration or sterilization of indoor air, sensible reprovision of lateral flow tests, and appropriate and supported isolation periods that will actually reduce ongoing transmission, he said. Meanwhile, COVID cases have risen almost 20% in a week, with 1 in 25 people in England thought to have had the disease at the end of June, official figures suggest. As a leading statistician said, hospitalizations from the latest surge may be topping off. According to the latest data from the Office for National Statistics, based on swabs collected from randomly selected households, an estimated 2.7 million people in Britain had COVID in the week ending 29 or 30th of June, an 18% rise on the week before, when almost 2.3 million people had the virus. In England alone, the most recent figure suggests about 1 in 25 people had a COVID infection in the last week of June, with a figure 1 in 17 in Scotland. Further analysis revealed infection levels had risen across all regions of England and in all age groups. These increases are due to rises in infections with the Omicron subvariants BA.4 and BA.5, which have been dominant since mid-June, said Sarah Crofts, the head of the analytical outputs for the COVID-19 infection survey. Scotland continues to have the highest infection rate, although it has recently increased at a slower rate compared with other regions of Britain. The total number of people in hospital in England who have tested positive for COVID stood at 11,878 on Thursday, an increase of 33% from the week before. While an increase was also evident in the number of people in hospital primarily due to COVID, with 3,749 such patients in England alone as of 5th of July.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with the concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4th, 2022 by Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. The dismembered body of Shahid Soleimani was bid farewell by millions of people. The people commemorated and respected a revolutionary and mujahid person who had laid down his life for the Islamic Republic like that. This is one example. There are many other examples as well, such as the case of religious scholars. The late Ayatollah Safi Gulpayegani was a marja taqlid, religious authority and faqih and jurisprudent. Notice what a great movement the people launched in his burial ceremony. The late Ayatollah Bahjat was a mystic and faqih. In his burial and farewell ceremony, the people of Qom filled that city with their emotions. People from other cities too went to Qom for his burial ceremony. You tell me for which other person from among outstanding political, artistic, and athletic personalities of the country would the people show such emotions? What does this show? Does this show the people's loss of belief in the clergy? Does it show the people's disbelief in religion, jihad, and resistance? They make such analyses. Their analyses are like this.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Notice what the people are doing about the song that has been released these days, which is an expression of one's love for the Imam of the age. May God hasten his reappearance and our souls may be sacrificed for his sake, and a greeting to him. Notice how enthusiastically they express their love. People, young, old, teenagers, children, women and men throughout the country do so. They do so in Tehran, Mashhad, Isfahan, Yazd, all in different ways. What is the reason for this? Is this a sign of people turning their backs on religion? Or is the other way around? In the beginning of the revolution, we did not have these things. In the beginning of the revolution, we did not witness the rushing of young students towards the centers of i'tikaf. We did not used to witness such great religious gatherings. Today, these things exist. So they have made a mistake about the Iranian nation. I could equally mention the 22nd of Bahman rallies. It is 43 years now that the people organized magnificent rallies on the 22nd of Bahman or on Quds Day. Is this a sign that the people have turned their backs on the revolution? This is a reason for the loyalty, resistance, and steadfastness of the people.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me from all.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Outside Belgium's largest asylum application centre, located at Le Petit Château, close to Brussels city centre. Dozens try to sleep, while dozens more queue up as they wait for the centre to open.
I claimed asylum 1 year ago and I still have nowhere to sleep. You can see all the people on the streets. There's no place to eat or to have a shower.
Look at them, you can see the situation. This situation has been from a long time ago. When you claim asylum, so you shouldn't be in the street like this.
We escaped war in Afghanistan. We came here for help, but have to sleep on the streets and in the park. There is no help for us.
These homeless people are mainly from African countries and Afghanistan. None are from Ukraine.
On the face of it, this might look like a Belgium problem, but perhaps we should be pointing the finger at the EU. The 27-country bloc has bent over backwards to provide housing and education for Ukrainian refugees and deliver a whole host of other benefits. Of course, nobody could argue with that. But is this not discrimination?
That's a question we put to the European Commission.
Is there a two-tier unfair asylum system in the EU?
We work closely with the member states that they have under their competence and with our support. They need to follow up and ensure contingency planning and adequate support for all those fleeing war and persecution so that there is no difference in their treatment.
Critics say Western nations tore countries in Africa and the Middle East apart and now turn their backs on displaced citizens. This as there is no end of money to support Ukrainians. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan in August 2021 is considered as one of President Biden's biggest failures. The NBC News revealed that the White House and U.S. agencies have started discussions on how to handle the anniversary of withdrawal to prevent further political damage to the president. Afghan experts believe that by reversing the truth, the Biden administration will try to sweep their failures under the carpet and turn a blind eye on the miseries of Afghans whose lives were spoiled by messy withdrawal.
The U.S. and Western propaganda have always had the skill of broadcasting a historical event in a way they want. The U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan has not been an exception to this rule. It's clear that the U.S. will whitewash its withdrawal mission in its anniversary to keep their global prestige. While we and the world witnessed the U.S. mess in the withdrawal from Afghanistan, as a result of their failure, a political system collapsed, NATO-Afghanistan agreement was broken, and dozens of Afghans were devastated. Most importantly, the U.S. lost its reputation as NATO gendarme.
Shahir, who is in hiding, was left behind by the U.S. He and his family members were asked to come to the airport, but weren't airlifted. He is angry with the U.S., and is still shocked from the sorrowful, frustrating, and insulting evacuation process. He says he feels betrayed by the U.S.
When I made it to the gate of the airport along with my family members, the NATO forces were firing bullets and tear gas everywhere. Inside Kabul airport, we witnessed four Afghans shot dead and three others injured by the U.S. forces. People were panicked, running everywhere. While I was showing my documents, NATO forces hit me with sticks and it started bleeding. Then I gave up as I felt insulted and betrayed by the U.S.
The U.S. 20-year devastating war on Afghanistan ended with a disastrous withdrawal. Several Afghans fell from American aircrafts. Some were shot dead and wounded. Many children were lost. Moreover, a U.S. airstrike hit a house in the airport neighborhoods, killing 10 family members, including women and children. The chaotic evacuation from Afghanistan in 2021 reminds Afghans of those ugly and tragic days. People here blame the ill-prepared U.S. for spoiling the lives of thousands of Afghan people. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Protesters from Palestine Action Scotland scaling the roof of one of the world's largest arms companies in Glasgow, demanding that the facility be shut down. They're soon arrested by Scottish police, but they've done the damage they intended.
They've obviously realized that asking nicely has not worked. The government hasn't made any lasting change, and they have taken measures into their own hands where the government has chosen not to.
The activists, who were taken in court and released later, accused the Paris-headquartered multinational TALS group of making an array of lethal weapons that help enforce the Israeli apartheid against Palestinians. The Watchkeeper drone is one of the group's deadly products, developed in collaboration with a notorious Israeli weapons company that's been the target of these activists for years now.
In 2019, TALS made 8.3 billion euros in profit, and that wasn't just off the suffering and oppression of Palestinians, it was from the oppression of refugees worldwide. Their business is oppression, their business is genocide, and they're willing to sacrifice millions upon millions of lives for profit.
The building behind me used to house the headquarters of Israel's largest weapons manufacturer, Elbit Systems. Earlier this year, and after 2 years of relentless direct action, Palestine Action say, they forced the company to close down and leave, getting one step closer to ending Israel's arms trade in Britain.
That came only 5 months after the company was forced to close up shop in the northwestern city of Oldham, Greater Manchester. Elbit Systems still has 8 more sites in the UK. Palestine Action say they will continue to throw a spanner in the works of Elbit and companies that collaborate with it, until they're all closed and until Palestine is free. Saeed Puriza, London.
On Tuesday, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian wrapped up a 2-day visit to Italy, which is expected to boost Tehran's relations.